This is Poured Over, a show about stories presented by the booksellers of Barnes & Noble.
I'm Miwa Messer. I'm the producer and host of Poured Over, and we are taping live tonight at our store on the Upper West Side of New York in front of a, wait for it, a live studio audience. I'm here with Genevieve Kingston, who I'm going to warn you now, I'm just going to keep calling her Gwen as we do this, because that is the name she goes by. And also, it's quite a groovy name. And Gwen's first book is out now, and it's a memoir. And it is unforgettable and smart and smashing and all of the things you want in a story. There's also the big beating heart of this memoir is not just Gwen, it's her mom, who died when she was 11. And your mom did something kind of extraordinary. And I'm going to ask you to introduce her to listeners. Mm.
Oh, what a joy to get to do that. My mom's name was Christina Maillard. Mm-hmm. And in the 8 or so years she had between her terminal diagnosis when I was 3 and her death when I was 11, mm-hmm. she decided to put together a special box. And inside she packed gifts and letters for every one of my birthdays until I turned 30. And for things like getting my driver's license and graduating high school and getting engaged and married and having my first child. So she wrote down one half of a conversation that we could keep having for years and decades after she died. And to me, this book is really me writing down my side mm-hmm. of that conversation and letting her know what's happened since she's been gone.
So in other words, you've written a life-affirming book about death.
I like to think so. Okay. My favorite line from one of my mother's letters, one of the last ones I ever opened, the one I opened most recently, is love is stronger than death. Mm-hmm. And I think that encapsulates a really deeply held belief of hers and the things she was trying to prove to herself, to me, with this project.
So obviously we're sitting in a bookstore, so we are spoiler free in this conversation. I have had the great pleasure of reading Gwen's book. I cannot wait for the rest of you to read Gwen's book. But there are many things that happen here, and if it sounds like we're dancing around a plot point, guess what? We are. Because I refuse to be the person who takes away the pleasure of reading this pretty special book from all of you. So you start with an essay, the Modern Love column in the New York Times, and you write a piece, and it's very specifically about the box and the letters. How does it feel to have your mom and your story out in the world like this? A book is a lot bigger than an essay, my friend.
Oh my gosh. Books are so long. Mm-hmm. It sounds silly, but I mean, before this, I wrote plays for many years, mm-hmm. and the longest play I've ever written was about 18,000 words, and this is sort of 75, 80,000 words. I mean, it's a totally different beast, and you're absolutely right that the Modern Love column was such a tight little sort of snowflake I got to craft, like with these little tiny tools, and then suddenly you have all of this freedom of space. Mm-hmm. But I'd actually started to work on the book before the essay came out. I wrote the essay first as an exercise for myself mm-hmm. to try to figure out the scope of the story, the beginning, middle, and end, what it was really going to be about, how it would move through time. And so once I had that kind of that little map for myself, then I felt like I could go back to the beginning and really write the whole story.
We are going to have a longer conversation about craft. I want to get people into the story first, because I have questions for you about craft. You learned an extraordinary amount about your parents and their marriage and their own lives. And I think every one of us goes through this when we realize our parents are actually people. And they're not just our parents. Like, they had lives before we showed up, and they had lives before they were married. And it's always a huge shock, right? It doesn't matter how old you are when you discover a thing about your parents. You're just like, wait a minute, you're my parents. You have no life. What is happening here? Let's talk about the materials you had access to outside of the box. I mean, obviously your mom created this amazing project for you, but there are videotapes. There were other letters. You were a very well-documented family.
We were, and I think part of that is because we always knew that we were, that this thing was coming, mm-hmm. right? This event of her death was something that I grew up always knowing was possible and even likely and then certain. And so part of it, I'm sure, was governed by that. Part of it was this need to capture these moments as they were happening, knowing that they were finite. But I think also part of it is just that's who my mom was. You know, she was that prepared. She was that meticulous.
So your mom grew up in the town that you and your brother grew up in.
Yeah, we grew up on the same street, a block and a half
Went apart. To the same middle school, mm-hmm. junior high too, mm-hmm. or just middle mm-hmm. school?
Same elementary school, same okay. middle school, same high school. Well, we went to the same high school. I graduated. She didn't.
Right. I'm sorry. Yeah. Okay. But your family is grounded in this community
yeah.
in a way that... I mean, I'm a Bostonian living in exile by choice. And if you know Boston, you may understand that quote. But you spent so much of your life in the shadow of your mom. Mm-hmm. And not just in terms of her illness. What does that mean for you?
You know, I think that my mom did loom large mm-hmm. in a lot of ways, mm-hmm. in life and in death. She was a formidable person. Mm-hmm. But I think one of her greatest gifts to my brother and myself right from the beginning was we always had permission to become ourselves.
Yeah.
And she always made us feel that she was just so excited to find out who we were and that it didn't necessarily have anything to do with who she wanted us to be or what was expected, but that she really, really wanted to find out.
And your dad had a similar view of the world in that way, but a slightly different parenting style, is that fair
Benign
to say?
Benign neglect, I believe, is what he liked okay. to call it.
Are you sure you weren't raised in the 70s? Because, I mean, we're lucky we survived the 70s.
No, but. Totally. I was raised, for the first 11, 12 years of my life, I was raised in, like now. Like, I was, like, a Gen Z, right? Like, with that okay. level of parental engagement. And then from 12 onward, I was a child of the 70s.
Okay. So you were raised by a wolf.
Basically. Okay.
Just checking. But now that the book is out, I mean, you have a couple of different points where you are either talking to friends. I mean, you've got a very tight high school group.
The Sensational Six.
Yeah, okay. I'm assuming you're all still together.
Absolutely.
Your brother's experience is your brother's experience. But there are moments with your partner, and obviously I'm not giving anything away, but you have a moment before you bring him in to sort of the actual story and the box itself, and yet here you are writing a book about the whole thing. When did you know that you had to tell the whole story?
I knew that I had to tell the whole story when I, in terms of the writing the book, I was 31 years old and okay. I had just finished opening all of those birthday presents.
Okay.
Right? So up through 30, I felt like there was a little bit of a map. Every year I got a little check-in with her. But I was 31, all the birthday presents were open, and what was left in the box was engagement, marriage, baby. And I was trying to figure out if those were things that I wanted for my future. And to do that, I felt like I had to go back through all my mom's letters, everything outside the box that you mentioned, the mm-hmm. clues that she'd left for me. She really had left this sort of scavenger hunt for me to follow for when I needed her, for when I needed right. someone to go to for these big life questions. Mm-hmm. And so that was when I knew I had to retrace all of this. And I had to write my side of the conversation.
But emotionally, you're sitting with all of her notes and all of this video and letters. And then your mom also did something really kind of extraordinary. And it made me quite like her even more. She had made it possible for her former psychiatrist to talk to you. And just, if my kid calls, tell her everything. Okay. I mean... I have some questions, which I am not going to ask you.
I mean, that was the gift,
it's
right?
It's wild. It's great.
She was willing to let us know all of her mm-hmm. if we wanted. Mm-hmm. The dark stuff, the complicated stuff. You know, she didn't need to remain this just sort of perfect, angelic, you know, figure with all of this, you know, preparation and care and birthday presents. She wanted us to know all of her if we wanted to. That right. was the offer. And I think it's an incredible offer.
I can't think of another parent in literature or off the page who would be willing, and again, this might be a New England thing because our old people do not talk about anything. They do not. They know they don't. But I love the idea that she was kind of like, all right, when you guys are ready, because she was really aware that she was not going to know you as adults. And that's a wild moment, I think, for a parent to realize that your kid is going to have an existence well beyond you. And I think that's hard for a lot of parents, right? Like, just in general, knowing that your kid is going to go on and have a life, but then you're not even there.
Yeah, I think it's what she worried about the most was that she knew, she believed that she would be a good ally to us as mm-hmm. we grew up. And she wanted so much to give us the benefit of her experience as we faced the world. And mm-hmm. she was so frustrated that she wasn't going to get that opportunity. She said in one of her videos that the idea for the whole project came from a fairy tale called The Story of Vasilisa, where the mom in the story is dying, and she gives her daughter a magic doll mm-hmm. and tells her that when things are difficult or she doesn't have enough knowledge to make the right to know what to choose or what path to take, talk to the doll, and the doll will, you know, will give her advice. And this was her trying to give each of us a magic doll that we could go to when we were in trouble.
Part of why I wanted to set up your mom so people had a really good idea of who she is and what you guys went through is that I had a lot of empathy and sympathy and compassion, all of the big words you're supposed to have for little Gwen, because little Gwen was in a rough spot, and man, you did not know. And the levels of anxiety, you were telling yourself that if you spent the night at a friend's house, your mother would die in the night, which for a tiny person, that's a lot. And that's not something an adult had told you. You just decided as a tiny person that you had this much to work with. And at one point you have a shrink say to you, well, wouldn't you be angry that your mom is sick? And you were like, why would I be angry that my mom is sick? And I can see the gears turning in little Gwen's head, or teenage Gwen's head, I guess. What was it like for you putting all of that on paper for strangers to see?
Oh, it was a really kind of joyful opportunity, actually, you know, really, to go back and talk, because I haven't seen a great deal of writing or of literature, novels, memoir. I haven't seen a lot that deal with what it's like to grow up as the child of a terminally ill parent.
Right.
And I know that we're out there because I've been in those support groups,
right?
Like,
right.
We're out there. And it's a very particular, odd experience. And of course, as a child, you know, you do make yourself the center of things and you do give yourself ridiculous powers, right? Like, mm-hmm. I can my having this slumber party might mean my mom, you know, dies tonight because I'm not there. Like, that's a ridiculous idea. But as children, we give ourselves that much power. We do imagine ourselves to have that kind of control over uncontrollable circumstances because we want to feel control.
But you also didn't have an outlet to process that. I mean, at one point you talk about feeling like you would lose all of your skin if you were apart from your mother.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are really big, complicated thoughts for a tiny person.
Yeah.
When did you finally start to let go of all of that?
Well, there's a spoiler in the book, and I won't go there, but there was a big event that happened about 10 years, almost exactly mm-hmm. 10 years after my mom died, and it was hugely difficult mm-hmm. for me to get through.
Right.
But it had the completely unexpected consequence of freeing me from that anxiety completely, because I realized that all the energy I had put into worrying about what would happen if I went too far from home or, you know, didn't kind of protect my familiar landscape, none of it had worked, right? It still happened. Terrible things could still happen. And so I let it go.
I'm sorry that's how it happened, but I'm glad for you that you were able to do that. But, you know, one of the pieces, and grief memoirs are their own thing, right? Like, I mean, we know, certainly Joan Didion, Sloane Crosley, I mean, there's a lot of work out there. There's a huge body of work on grief out there. And there are a couple of elements that are always really hard to talk about. So we might sort of scoot around this a little bit, but I'm still going to ask. Anger, you know, that's a piece of grief.
Can be.
Shame.
Yeah.
Is a piece of grief. And those are the parts where none of us want to talk about it, right? Like, you just want to sort of muscle your way through. If I make lists, everything will be fine. There will be another side to all of this. But sitting with the past feelings, right? Like, you've just made it clear you've done a ton of work. You've gotten, you know, to some sort of side. But the shame and the anger. Like, even as adults, we don't really have the vocabulary for that. We're getting better, right? As a culture and a society, we're getting better about how we talk about this. But where else did you find the resources to process all of that, separate from the incident that we're not really discussing?
Two things, really. I mean, I was fortunate to be held by an extraordinarily strong community, both of extended family and friends. And in many ways, to me, this is a book about, like, everyone doing an incredibly good job under, like, really awful circumstances. Right, right. Like, people showed up for our family in this extraordinary way. And part of that, again, I credit my mom with being really open about her illness and allowing people to go on that journey with her if they wanted. Mm-hmm. And her friends have spoken about what it meant to them to right. be allowed in to the journey of someone who's dying and who is having these realizations and revelations and getting to share in those. So that was one thing. But another thing was the arts, was writing and acting. I mean, I needed those places to be to feel my feelings mm-hmm. fully in ways that, you know, you can't go to school every day feeling all of your feelings about, you know, about grief. It's just there isn't space and stuff has to get done. And but to go to step into a theater or to get onto the page and to be just fully in it, I mean, I needed it so much.
And you found your way to the theater as a teenager, right? Adolescent?
That's when I started getting sort of taking myself seriously.
But your mom had a really cool line that you drop early in the book, and your mother just says to you, "You're a changeling."
Yeah.
One of my kids is a changeling. One of them is just a kid, all due respect. But your mother was just like, "Who are you? Like, what tiny person? Where did you come from?" Oh, dialogue. When you were 7, your mom said, "Well, you're either going to be an actor or a writer because you have an ear for dialogue." And I will tell you, having read this book, yes, you have an ear for dialogue. So can you just let listeners in on what it was like when you realized that you just did want to do the thing and be on stage? We'll get to the words in a second, but there was a physical piece that I'm pretty sure did sort of tip you into healing more than not.
Yeah.
And you write about it in the book.
Yeah, the first time that I was in an acting class in high school, and I was doing this, you know, really sad monologue that was, you know, kind of really not appropriate for me. I think it was like a 30-year-old woman, and I was sort of 15 or something. But I was doing the monologue, and I started to cry. And then I looked up, and everyone in the room was crying with me. Mm-hmm. And it was magic. I couldn't mm-hmm. believe that I could change someone's internal weather using words mm-hmm. and hand gestures, right? Mm-hmm. And that we could cry together. I mean, I needed to cry with people. Mm-hmm. You know, it's something I needed. And on stage, we could be in that space together in a way that my teenage friends couldn't really hold that space for me necessarily easily right. at that age. But in a theater, we could all be there together.
And you talked, too, about your brother and his imaginary worlds, right? He had D&D. He mm-hmm. had Lego. Mm-hmm. You did not have that. Mm. He was not going to let his little sister get into his stuff. All of that. But this really, those imaginary worlds, on stage are the thing that held you.
Yeah. I think we both needed magic. We both right. needed different worlds where the givens were changed, where...
Which brings me to Philip Pullman and the Golden Compass.
Oh, my God.
Right? Okay, we have to talk about these books for a second. Because you're reading them together, and I love... Anytime I hear about people reading books together, I get very excited. And, in fact, this happens a lot at our house, but it's mostly road testing. I'm like, what do you think of this? So it's less about, oh, my... just the sheer joy of whatever magical thing is happening. But... Your mom did not think you were old enough for the second volume of The Golden Compass.
I know. I wasn't allowed to read it. Jamie was allowed to read it.
Uh-huh. Wait, what's the age difference between you guys?
4 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he's a little bit older. All
yeah.
right. But still. I love the idea, though, that your mom was like, you know what, this is just really scary and it's not going to work.
She found it terrifying. And mm-hmm. I don't know, spoilers for the... Yeah. I think it's been out long enough.
It really has.
There are these creatures in the book that are mm-hmm. called specters. And right. they only attack adults, not children, and they devour your soul. And she found this so terrifying. And she was, you know, said, no, you're not. It's too scary. I read it, you know, eventually and thought, I don't know what she thinks this is. I mean, like, yeah, it's get whatever. But like, I don't know. I don't know what the big deal is. And it wasn't until later when she was finally, you know, right. at the end of her life and kind of losing herself and sleeping more and more. And I think she was so scared of thinking, oh, my God, what if my kid is there and they need me and I don't have the internal resources left to care for them the way that I want to. I think that was really scary for her.
But Star Trek. Yeah. You go from Philip Pullman There's a lot of Star Trek early in this memoir, and I was not expecting that.
There is. More Star Trek, okay. And then slowly the Star Trek was got edged off the page, and then eventually my editor was like, do we need any Star Trek? And I was like, the Star Trek stays!
I think we need some Star Trek. Just as a non-Star Trek person, I'm just saying we need some Star Trek, so I'm glad there is some Star Trek in here. It's such an American pop culture thing, though, but you guys used it in a way... almost like you use the Pullman books to talk to each other. Yeah. You were using Star Trek, and I didn't realize there were quite that many Star Treks. That's on me, totally on me. But I love
the
idea
that
Star Trek. Okay, but I'm really glad that Star Trek was your family thing.
Oh my God! Yes, absolutely.
Are you still watching Star Trek?
I am. I am. Okay. It's not what it used to be.
Okay.
But but no, it was. It was this nostalgia. I mean, I think Star Trek, I feel like, has this quality that it's nostalgic even while it's happening. If that makes any sense,
it has
that future thing. But no, I mean, I was obsessed with time travel as a kid because I really wanted to figure out the way that you could change things that weren't changeable. So in my reality, there were some really tough things that were not changeable, mm-hmm. and I kept being told they were not changeable.
Right.
So I think I was drawn, and I think my brother was drawn to fantasy, to sci-fi, to magic, to anything where you could work around these things, right? You could change the timeline, wave the wand.
Oh, I don't think you guys were the only ones who wanted that kind of thing. I think that's just human nature.
Yeah.
To say, not in love with this moment. How do I turn it on its ear? How long were you in Massachusetts? How long were you technically at Tufts? Like a week?
Oh, if that.
Okay.
Okay.
I dipped a toe in and just said,
And all respect to Tufts. It had nothing to do with Tufts. And all respect to Massachusetts. It had nothing to do with Massachusetts.
Okay.
And everything to do with me.
Okay. Which, again, young Gwen... I'm really glad we're sitting here having this conversation. I feel much better seeing you in front of me right now. And I will say, if you're reading the book, you can get a very clear picture of Gwen's trajectory. But this woman can write, like straight up, this woman can write, and you will have all of the feels, and best to be prepared to have all of the feels. I don't think this is a sit down and read it in one go kind of book, but you end up studying... at Berkeley, you got a couple of bachelor's degrees, because why just get one? I mean, why not do multiple?
Well, no one wanted to graduate in the economy at the time.
That's fair.
That's like, I'll give me another major.
That's totally fair. But you end up studying acting back on the East Coast. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to read something that you wrote in the book, because I love this line. Graduate school for actors, I discovered, was a lot like having your body and mind taken apart and then put back together. Before we could learn to act, we were told we had to learn how to walk, how to speak, how to breathe. We practice taking up space. And when I hit that riff in your book, I couldn't help but think that's how you got to the place where you could write this book. And I realize you've written a couple, 3 one-act plays and 4 plays?
Something like that, yeah.
So, I mean, obviously you're working with words, but a play is a very different format. Mm. From narrative prose, right? But yet you're taking up space with this book in a way that, you know, occasionally women are told, maybe you should just sit over there and have your feelings and we'll come back to you. Right?
Yeah, it's
so can we talk about the physicality of acting, though? What you take from acting to be able to do what's in this memoir?
I love that question. Yeah, I mean, I think stories are stories. Mm-hmm. And I think that different stories demand different media, demand different containers.
Right.
And so when you're working on the paint, when you're writing a play or acting in a play, right, everything is about what's not said. Everything is about subtext. Everything is about, you know, this letting the audience fill in the blanks. Mm-hmm. And I mean, there's a lot of that. There are a lot more words, obviously, in a book, but I think it's the same thing applies in many ways where you want to give these characters interiority. You want to make sure that the reader feels like they have access and they understand.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also how little can you do before they get? How much can you trust your reader to go on their own experience and to not insist on what a thing means,
mm-hmm.
right? You make an offering and you hope that they meet you where you're at.
Well, and I think, too, a reader will always bring their own experience to whatever the book is. So it kind of is a little bit out of your hands once you put the book out into the world, right? Like, you hand it over to the reader, and I don't think any of us in this space are going to have the same response. We're going to have similar responses. We're all going to connect somehow, but we're not necessarily going to have the same response to the experience of reading.
Absolutely. And it's actually what I hope for and look for when I'm engaging with a piece of art, a book or a painting or a play. I am hoping that it's going to make me start to reflect on my own experience, because that takes me out of my critical brain of like, how good is this? How much do I like this? Would it have been better if the sofa was over under the window? I mean, you know, it takes you out of that space and it puts me in a place of I'm filling in my side of the story. I'm having my own relationship. My own memories are coming up. And that's, you know, what I'm always hoping for.
I just want to follow that up with an audience question. What are the different forms this story has taken in your creative life? Because I think there was a play, right? Directly.
I think the first time I sort of engaged with this was when I was still at Brown. I was in the MFA program and I did for my thesis project, I did like a 25-minute one-woman show about these. And then put that away, enjoyed doing that. And then it wasn't until all the theaters had closed in 2020. Right. And I felt I needed to write differently because there was no way to make plays right then. And so that's when I started feeling my way around in the dark, feeling for what this might be. I thought it might be a book. I found the essay.
Right.
And then I figured out my way in.
Can we talk about literary influences for a second?
Yeah.
Let's start with playwriting, and then we'll move on to prose and whatever else there might be. But, okay. Do we have a top list of playwrights for you?
Of course. The amazing Sarah Rule, who also has a beautiful, beautiful memoir, Smile. Paula Vogel, Timberlake, Wurtenbacher. It was absolutely stunning, stunning playwright. I think a really formative writing influence for me was Aaron Sorkin, who started as a playwright.
Recently found myself watching the first few episodes of The West Wing, which I had missed the first time out. Raised by Wolves. Okay, just straight up, Raised by Wolves. And yeah, I was like, oh, now I understand. And I'd seen like The Social Network and whatnot, so it's not like I was unfamiliar with his work. But those first few episodes, I was like, oh, now I get it.
It's
I'm a little late, but I get it.
You can't laugh at the jokes because you'll miss what's next.
Yeah, yeah, totally.
Right? So he keeps you in this state of suspended. You're always trying to have a reaction that you can't finish because the next thing's coming at you. It's just, I continue to be astonished.
Dialogue. I mean, I notice when the dialogue is clunky.
Oh, yeah.
And it throws, nothing will take me out of a story. I work in an industry where dragons are a thing. I have a big belief in lots of things, you know, ghosts. I'm down with all of it. It's fine. But clunky dialogue will just yank me out.
Well, because it breaks the trust, right? It breaks your trust with your reader that even if they're fictional characters, because at that point, you know, if you've made it a certain way through, you feel like you know who they are a little bit. And you're like, they wouldn't have said that. And certainly with a memoir, I think you're always making sure you want to keep trust with your reader. You don't want to put a line in a child's mouth that doesn't sound like a child.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah, the 40-year-old, the 8-year-olds who sound like 40-year-olds? No, thank you.
Yeah.
No.
So you can't make, you know, you can't give my 9-year-old self, right, the vocabulary or the insights of my adult self, right? Or else people can, I don't buy it, right? That's what you want to, you want them to put it down because they're like, I just don't buy it.
Well, and dialogue moves the story forward in ways that would be so on the nose otherwise. And you kind of don't even realize that you're turning pages as quickly as you are when the dialogue is good. I mean, stuff just flies. I'm actually, The Bee Sting by Paul Murray is almost 600 pages, and you would not know it. You absolutely would not know it because of the way the dialogue moves. And he even has one character who does not get any punctuation in their chapters, and I had convinced myself because of that there was no punctuation in any of the book, and I went back before I was sitting down to interview him, and I was like, oh, wait a minute. I remembered this a little differently. But again, it's the dialogue that is constantly pushing that narrative forward, and I do always suspect that when someone's really good at dialogue, there's some playwriting, or at least the reading of plays that's happened, because there's really no one who, like, even someone like Eric Gurney or Stoppard, I mean, when you think about how the cadence moves, right? But let's talk about prose writers for a second, because obviously you're pulling from a lot of different places.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I have been a huge reader my whole life, but when I started this project, I was like, I need to read every memoir I can get my hands on. I mean, I was like an open call, saying, everyone send me the best memoir, help me find the best ones, because I needed to understand where my book lived in this landscape.
Right.
And so, I mean, I was just devouring memoirs for several years. Favorites, you know, for different reasons, include Autobiography of a Face by Lucy Greeley. So lyrical, so gorgeous. She knows exactly how much we can take, how much of her struggle and pain and all of that we can take before we're going to turn away. Yep. And she dials it just right. Stunning book, The Bright Hour by Nina Riggs, which in many ways I feel is like the flip side of my story because it's from the mother's perspective in a very similar situation. In The Dream House, Carmen Maria Machado, I took courage from her to be audacious on the page, to write poetically and like just go for it. Mm-hmm. And so many others. Truth and Beauty by Ann Patchett. I mean, there's just
and it's
so many.
Wild reading Truth and Beauty with Autobiography of a Face. Oh.
Like, that's more at its best because you believe you're like you're in that friendship, right? Like you're one of them. You feel like.
Before I let this get away from us, what's the significance, if any, of the ginkgo leaves on the cover?
So ginkgos have a lot of significance for me. The street where I grew up was lined with them, and every fall they turn bright gold. They fall to the ground. They are the best leaves in the world to leaf fight with because they are completely soft and you can throw them right in someone's face and you won't scratch their eyeballs. Every Thanksgiving, my brother and my cousins would have this big leaf fight. And my grandmother, my mom's mom, who's in the book, she could see these leaves outside of her window. And at the very end of her life, she was writing in her journal about being a little girl in London and hearing about what America was like and hearing that the streets of America were paved with gold.
Right.
And that was her little, how that was fulfilled for her.
Yeah, I'm sorry I didn't get to meet your grandmother in real life because she sounded
really
like
cool.
A character.
Oh my
gosh. She sounded like, I had some pretty groovy old people. New England jokes aside, I had some very groovy old people in my life. And it's amazing the stories that you can pull out. You have to catch them at the exact right moment. They're great.
Oh,
they're really, really great.
I wish I could have had some conversations with her. I have her journals, which are pretty awesome. But I wish I could have. Yeah. Again, so many people we wish that we could live to say all of the things, to say all of the things we mean to say and for there to be enough time.
Right. Yeah, it's a little bit of a, hey, if you've been meaning to do it, you might just want to do it.
That's really what I hope people take from this book. Say the thing you want to say to the person you love and say it right now.
I don't know, that seems like a really good place to end this episode. So I'm going to say thank you to everyone in the audience. Thank you for joining us. Thank you, Gwen.
Thank you so much.
Genevieve Kingston, when you go into the store looking for the book. Did I Ever Tell You is out now. And I just want to say thank you again. This was great.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for being
here. Thank you for listening. Poured Over is a Barnes & Noble production. To help other readers find us, please rate and review the show wherever you listen to podcasts.